Welcome to another unpredictable episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on American Freedom Radio for the listening discomfort of people who like to remain inside a cushioned bubble of ignorance that encloses upon them every single day that they continue to ignore the outside world as it's being portrayed to them on the mainstream everything. The mainstream everything. Have you been familiar with the concept, ladies and gentlemen, that there actually is an everything mainstream? That there is an alternative for nothing. Truly. Isn't that funny? Do you want to get some kind of alternative government, some kind of one that's not oppressive, that's not corrupt, that's not privately owned or privately influenced by scumbaggery? No? Well, that's good, because there is no alternative. Right, you've got to either destroy whatever it is that exists today and then rebuild it another way. Or you can follow it through to its logical conclusions, which wind up destroying everything and keeping it dead. Kind of forever. That's, you know, that really weird juxtaposition that people find themselves in this day and age. But nonetheless, we have some entertaining to do and some jokes to tell. I'll come up with them off the top of my head as they come to me, because, after all, just because we're being exterminated doesn't mean we can't make it fun. Otherwise, what's the point of being killed? My very special guest is Jay Dyer. Jay, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Vinny. Glad to be here.
It's an absolute pleasure and an honor to have you on the show. Would you be able to explain to the audience a little bit about yourself and what it is you do?
Yeah, I'm a guy from the southern U.S. who studied philosophy, film, history, geopolitics, psychological warfare in college. And then I pursued that into grad school and continued to study those same fields. And ended up in a big argument with my thesis advisor while I was about halfway through my thesis, and walked out and decided to do this. So now I do jaysanalysis.com, which is a website dedicated to those same outlets. And basically what it is is pretty much, I would brag, I guess, one of the premier philosophy and film sites on the internet. So now I get to, for a living, write film reviews, film analyses. I do sketch comedy. I do public speaking. And I just finished my first book called Esoteric Hollywood, Sex, Cults, and Symbols in Film. And I also write for 21st Century Wire and Soul of the East.
And what made you give up the normal chain of events for someone studying your field?
Once you realize what academia really is, that, I mean, I heard an interview with you where you were talking about your own experiences in college and how it was about brainwashing and that they were there to, you know, essentially manipulate. And that was my experience. And I felt like, you know, just got to the tipping point where it's, if you don't go along with what the academic establishment believes, then you're not really going to be welcomed into academia. And it's very clicky. It's very cliquish. So to be successful in the academic realm, because I was working on a master's and wanted to pursue a PhD, you really have to go along with, you know, all the points that the establishment has, be it globalism, be it climate change, be it Darwinian evolution, be it whatever. If you don't support feminism, social justice warriors, if you don't support all those things, it's going to be very difficult for you, especially if you're a heterosexual male in that field, trying to get a job, trying to get tenure and so forth. So for me, I decided, you know what, I can actually do all this on my own. I can lecture, I can teach people. So that's what I do at my site. I offer lectures on classics of Western philosophy, Plato, Aristotle, and Tragedy and Hope by Carol Quigley. So that's the present series I'm doing. So why do we even need those institutions? They're pretty much defunct anyway. Large state university school systems are really useless. We live in an age where anybody can start their own media outlets through the internet and be successful.
Yeah. Oh, fuck. Oh, hey. Sorry, my thing won't unmute. Am I unmuted?
Hello? I hear you.
Oh my god, it's so weird. There's a weird mute button thing and a whole bunch of messaging things coming out.
Don't touch your thing there, Benny.
Okay, so that's good. Now, anyway, the problem with university education is that it doesn't really cater to the individual. It caters to the group, right? Because you've got a huge lecture hall full of people, right? Usually quite young with very little life experience, right? So they're quite easy to manipulate. And absolutely. By manipulate, I mean fill their heads full of all these ideas and ram it down their throats and go, this is the truth, this is what it is. And essentially what they turn into is a form of symbiotic parasite that will attach itself to the host, which is society, in whichever field they wish to replicate in. Let's say you're a philosophy student and you attach on to your philosophy professor or whatever, and you go on eventually to replace him along the way. Or you're an engineering student and you wind up replacing some kind of engineer in some way. In this established, documented thinking stratagem, right? So that the entirety of society is a perpetual motion machine that keeps pushing itself forward. And as the Hunchback of Notre Dame has taught us, there's a certain point where unlimited growth is just not good looking and not healthy.
It's a Rube Goldberg machine of insanity and madness. If you know what I'm talking about, the Rube Goldberg machine where all the different parts all function together and it's supposed to be like a perpetual motion machine. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, in the U.S., and I assume it's this way in most Western first world countries, the large institutions, foundations have really steered the course of American education. And they do that, of course, through the donors, the board members, and so forth, that pretty much set a standardized agenda for what texts are appropriate, what professors can teach on, and so forth. Now, as you move up, you know, in grad school, it gets a little more flexible. You can choose different topics. But for the most part, the standardized school system, it's openly known to be from the Prussian state model that's all about social engineering. I mean, I've done a lot of work on the history of American education. And you look at the founders, John Dewey, Horace Mann, they were openly socialists and collectivists who, echoing what you just said, explicitly said that the purpose of schooling is not education, but socialization. And so in that sense, they mean the normalization, the standardization of human thinking, basically to make you a better office slave. And so it's absolutely worthless unless you're going for some trade, like you mentioned, like engineering or mathematics or some field like that. But for the most part, absolutely across the board for the humanities, you can't really do very well with art or literature or history, because these are now all controlled by pretty radical Frankfurt School, social Marxist, cultural Marxism, if you know what I mean. And that's pretty much the dominant attitude amongst Western higher level academia.
It's a craziness that I've likened. Well, I call them academia nuts. Let's just put it like that. They've got this concept that the world is the way it is because they've been told the way it is. Now, to break into that shell of asking that question to themselves, because that's what intelligent people do. They ask questions rather than just read the information. Have I been duped? Right. Am I being bullshitted here, right? It's that point in the conversation with the salesman when you start to realize that the salesman's actually telling you lies to get you to buy something. And how best do you deal with this relationship is you cut the relationship off. Now, I understand that there are certain fields of expertise where people, you know, need to get their qualifications in order to get it to be a doctor, for example. But the problem is the medical industry is the leading cause of fucking death. So how's that working out for you? You got your qualification. That means you're a professional now. Does it mean you're safe? Huh?
They don't know anything about nutrition, for example. I know plenty of people who went to medical school and they drink Diet Coke and they take their vaccines and they eat GMOs. They have no concept of simple facts about what you think a doctor might be involved with, health. I mean, those two things seem to go together, yet they're completely two different worlds. And so, yeah, the medical establishment is really an arm of the pharmaceutical insurance establishment. And so they're, just like you were saying about everything else being private corporate mainstream versions of everything. Well, that's what medicine is its own basically dysgenics operation, while it simultaneously saps everybody's pensions and savings as you're paying for all these treatments that the system itself caused through the garbage that you ate your whole life.
Yeah, like it's a very simple dynamic. If you want to make some money as a pharmaceutical company that kills a whole lot of people with its drugs that are very, very dangerous, it's a simple fix. You fund universities and tell them to exclude certain other treatments from their curriculum of medicine, and then when all these graduates come out, they only recommend one thing to their patients: your medicine. If you are in a dental school, you might find out that dental school is funded by Colgate, who are big fluoride proponents. And what are they going to teach you about fluoride then? Are they going to teach you the truth that it's one of the kind of worst carcinogen ever discovered? They're not going to do that, are they? No, they're going to give you the mainstream establishment line. You go on and you replicate the program. Now, every program, however, has ghosts in the machine. We heard of this concept, right, where even though a part of the machine, even if it's mechanical or digital, is being programmed in a certain way, it has the ability to respond and change in ways that cannot be predicted. And I think this is what happens to people like you and me when we go into the system and we start to realize that it is a system and that we are part of the code and we don't fit in because we're a fractured code.
Yeah, and the irony of it is that, for example, I was doing philosophy, and one assumes that the discipline of philosophy is about critical thinking and reasoning through positions, and actually, I know this is unheard of, but reading the other guy's position and trying to understand it to some degree, right? And so when you actually try to put that into practice, when you're in the midst of college classes or whatever, you start to realize that that's not what you're there for. And so, for example, I mentioned earlier Tragedy and Hope, which is this big, massive tome by Dr. Carol Quigley about the history of the West from the Council on Foreign Relations archives, a very prominent figure who basically wrote an apologetic, a defense of the West, saying that everything that we've been doing for the last 20th century that the bankers have run, this is all good because ultimately it's going to produce liberal democracy for the world. Well, I had the book with me one day in grad class, and I was reading it, and the professor, for whatever reason, he was the head of the English department, the radical Marxist that I'm talking about, this insane collectivist, stands up and he says, you know, there's some idiots out there that actually believe that there's a move for global government. And I said, well, actually, there is. I'm reading a book from those guys at the global government at the CFR, and they talk about it. And he said, oh, let me guess, you're one of these Glenn Beck people. And I was like, I can't stand Glenn Beck. He's fucking awful, right? And so we ended up in this huge fight. The guy kicks me out of class because I started reading quotes from Tragedy and Hope. So if you actually do what our school had, this motto, like this one of those cheese ball banners that they hang up everywhere that's like, our students are all about excellence and studiousness and all this bullshit, right? So I'm like, I'm showing you excellence, studiousness, critical thinking, and it gets me kicked out of the fucking class. So what better example than that?
Yeah, it's like when you join the cops to protect and serve, and you find that the first thing you're doing is protecting the bankers and serving people warrants.
Yeah, and dealing drugs, right?
I mean, hey, man's got to eat, right?
Well, I don't know how it is where you are, but I mean, the cops around here,
it's the same deal. Like, okay, all right, it's cops, gangs, judiciary, intelligence agencies, drugs.
Yeah.
All in this beautiful little nexus so that it goes round in a perpetual merry-go-round where the prison industrial complex gets a whole bunch of new slaves for their little roadside projects as well that they can filter off to their criminal friends. It's beautiful. It's just beautiful.
And sometimes the universities are actually involved in those drug rings because it's a great market for selling drugs. Now, that's lower on the totem pole, but we've had universities around here, large ones, 40,000 kids get busted for being part of a larger drug ring. So not only that, the university I attended was busted for a large, I kid you not, textbook what do you call it? A plagiarism scandal, right? So the guy who's tied into providing textbooks was actually just printing his own copies of other people's textbooks. And this was a huge scandal, locally speaking, obviously. But I mean, that's what you're getting into. It's like these people are immensely corrupt, even at the local level, and especially amongst these institutions, these so-called prestigious universities that are getting millions and millions of people's tax dollars and private donations. It's a racket.
Yeah. It's just a scam, just like any other. We were going to the supermarket the other day, and there was a dude outside the supermarket who was a salesman, and I know salesmen because I used to be one, and I can smell my own kind.
Yeah, me too.
And I know what they're like, really, underneath. The ones that don't have a conscience, the ones that aren't actually there to make sure that this product is actually right for you before taking your money. That kind of salesman, that's what I saw. And you know what he was collecting money for, right, outside the supermarket? Cancer research, you know? And I didn't have my camera on him. I didn't go up and say anything to him or anything like that because it was my 10-year anniversary with my wife. And but it's just sitting there, and he's talking to these people about how he got into sales, right? And this is a guy who's there. I'm trying to raise money for cancer research, and I'm talking about sales, right? Now, dude, hold on a second. There's an intellectual gap that's kind of happened here in the entirety of society, I think, where the means to an end are no longer understood by anybody who's anywhere near the production line, right? They don't even know why they're doing what they're doing or what it actually produces. Now, had I talked to him, I would have said, how many cancer cures has this organization you're representing ever produced? None, eh? And how long have they been around? Oh, about 10, 15 years, eh? And how much money have they raised, eh? Oh, a couple of $100 million, right? A couple of $100 million over a couple of years to produce absolutely nothing. And that's why they need salesmen like you to convince people to continue giving them money and make them feel good about it while they're getting scammed.
Yeah, I worked at a cell phone, I guess you could say, outlet one time. And I did that for about a year, and I was doing sales there. And I think anybody who has any kind of conscience eventually learns that you're not going to move up the sales ladder. You might be able to stay at some mediocre level, but to move up, you really have to sell products to old people that they don't need, right? Sell them up it and sell them the iPad instead of just the iPhone or whatever. And that's how sales works. And it's no different in the larger scale scams that we're talking about. I was reading earlier, I don't know what your view about the Mars mission and all that is, but I tend to be a skeptic about anything from NASA. And I was reading that James Cameron, the big Hollywood director, Titanic, Avatar, right, made two of the biggest movies of all time, billions of dollars. I write a lot about Hollywood stuff. Well, it turns out James Cameron is actually an advisor on the NASA Mars mission and colonization of Mars. Now, doesn't that sound really neat and Star Trek-y? Yeah, okay. But then you look and you see who else is involved in this. Well, it's these other billionaires, right? And they're trying to raise millions and millions of dollars. I assume they're being successful to colonize Mars. Now, we'll never actually know, I don't think in our lifetimes for sure, if any of these people actually do this. Certainly James Cameron, with his special effects wizardry, could film something like that. So my assumption is that I don't think that James Cameron is that interested in actually going to Mars, but I think it's a great way to fleece people in a racket who think that he is, for example, some kind of great scientific explorer, right? So in other words, people play these roles, and it's just really at different levels, a strata of society, depending upon the level of the racket or the scam, right? The international drug market.
There's one caveat on that, because James Cameron has a reputation for actually going to extremes, not only in his films, but actually in the real world, like diving to the deepest places on the earth to film creatures that nobody's ever seen, diving to the actual wreck of the Titanic in the mini subs with Anatoly Seglevich, who's from one of famous Russian maritime expert. And if you want to think about another world, right, on Earth, that's probably where you'd go. So what's the next logical step once you've done that, if you're James Cameron and the only thing you want to do is go to the next biggest thing, go from Terminator to Terminator 2, go from diving to the Titanic, diving to the Mariana Trench, go to Mars?
Well, yeah, I understand.
That would be one logical thing for me.
I understand the logic of that.
However, that's only one caveat upon a whole bunch of other things where we see a massive amount of faked footage of space and space exploration going off. And we hear Van Allen radiation belt, for example. How are you going to get through that? They still haven't explained how they got through it and got to the moon. They still haven't explained how they're going to get through it to get to Mars. Well, they still haven't explained that.
Yeah. The other thing about Cameron is that he's not just a philanthropist or a scientific explorer, so-called. Maybe he really did. I've seen Aliens of the Deep, so I know what you're talking about. Maybe he really did those things. But I think that when you're at that level, if you're Elon Musk or somebody like that or Peter Thiel, you are playing a role. You're not somebody who organically just rose into that position without the establishment's approval, right? So that's why we see James Cameron promote all the globalist green agenda. He's very much into climate change and globalism. And so I don't think you can trust anybody like that. I mean, you look at the other billionaires who've been caught in so many frauds. You look at Soros and what he does across the globe. And I'm just saying that it's a class of people. Maybe there are some really great billionaires. I don't know. But you look at Oprah. I mean, Oprah's all about meetings with Rockefellers on depopulating the earth. Bill Gates is all about depopulation. So I think it's a club of people that you're not really let into unless you're a pretty adept psychopathic scammer. I would also say, just to add one last point there, is that I don't think that it's accidental that NASA chose James Cameron to be in charge of filming so many of these Mars things. I mean, he's the lead guy on filming this. Now, you could say, well, he's good at making movies, so that makes sense. Yeah, but if you understand what NASA is, it's under the aegis of the Air Force, and that is a military institution. And if you understand the connections between Hollywood and the Pentagon and the CIA, which is something that I detailed in hundreds of articles at my website, then it becomes clear that so much of this is Hollywood. So I kind of view NASA as like a big stage, a big set, a big Hollywood set, really. And so it functions mainly to promote propaganda. That's my view. And I also think that the best book on the moon issue is, if you like Dave McGowan's Wagging the Moon Doggy book, really sealed it for me that NASA is just a propaganda outlet.
And think about Hollywood, like a lot of the messages in, say, Michael Bay films, for example, very, very pro-US agenda, military interests, et cetera, right? And it turns out that he's got, you know, his own line to the Pentagon. You know, he can just call up somebody at the Pentagon, hey, what will you do with this particular scene with all of this military equipment and that kind of thing? And he jokingly references and he says, well, you know, if you want to mess with me, you're messing with a guy who has a direct line to the Pentagon. So,
exactly. And it's public that, you know, Stanley Kubrick worked openly with NASA at that time to help film things. So NASA's had this penchant for using, you know, the big Hollywood directors. And in my view, you know, if you look at the history of the origin of the film camera, all the way back to World War One and World War Two, it's always been used for propaganda. In fact, there was a big article that came out even in mainstream media this week that some of the most famous World War Two footage is actually just propaganda stagecraft out of Hollywood. If you look at the atomic bomb testing footage, that's publicly mainstream news was filmed at Laurel Canyon Studios, which was a private studio out in California. Now it's the home of Jared Leto, by the way. He actually bought the facility and turned it into a house. I drove past it a couple months ago and snapped some pics when I was out in LA. So it's pretty amazing when you really dig into the interconnection between the Pentagon, the CIA, the Air Force, and Hollywood. It's just absolutely 100%. And I'm glad you mentioned Michael Bay. You can also look at Jerry Bruckheimer. He was actually involved in consulting on the filming of the Jessica Lynch incident, which was part of the military's propaganda to get women in the military, because that whole story is completely staged and fake, admittedly now. But Jerry Bruckheimer consulted on what the Pentagon should do to film that scenario. And so in my view, the mainstream news is really just kind of another version of the way Hollywood works. And that's why even now in movies, Skyfall, different films, you see Anderson Cooper, Wolf Blitzer, CNN reporters actually appear in the movies playing their roles as reporters. Sanjay Gupta's been in movies, right? So, I mean, they're really flip sides of the same coin. They're not different entities.
There's two things that have happened in recent history is that the news and entertainment, the lines have blurred, and the news and comedy, the lines have blurred, right? So, like, the comedians have now become the newsmen because the newsmen turn themselves into a joke.
Yeah, I made that argument, actually. I've said for a while now, especially since the Obama presidency, it's like we live in a Saturday Night Live skit. And then Obama goes and does SNL-type skits. I'm not joking. You can find these online. It's so ridiculous. I mean, we literally live in a giant sketch comedy. And that's, I think, because if you read, say, Empire of Illusion by Chris Hedges, he talks about this simulacrum that we live in. And America really has the history of being a nation of simulacrum or simulation. Everything to if you go out to Vegas, you see these little bitty monuments of all the other places in the world. If you go to Disneyland, you see Epcot Center with these little bitty monuments of the fake versions of the real world. And, you know, we put out the toxic Hollywood culture to the rest of the globe that every other nation mimics. And it's all simulacrum, it's all simulation. And so I think that phantasmical world that we have projected across the globe through the 2D screen is really the power that the New World Order, the establishment, whatever you want to call it, the oligarchs, that's how they have their power, is this 2D screen reality that gives us the template by which we then interpret the world incorrectly, unfortunately, most of the time.
This is why it's called television programming. Now, the concept here, I am really into the Hollywood thing and movie trivia and that sort of business. And I have, at last count, 650 screenshots of Masonic floors, all seeing eyes, references to the number 33, etc., from every kind of film genre, across every kind of film year. Across any kind of actor, doesn't matter, it's synonymous. Now, back in the 1950s, I believe it was, I'll have to check this with Freighter X and James Wright, but there was a memo that was put out about indoctrinating society into this framework so that they would be more pliable for a world government, and what kind of imagery that they could put into popular culture in order to facilitate that. And they said that the imagery of ancient Egypt and the culture of Freemasonry would be the best bet. And ever since the release of that document, you see the Masonic imagery and these order out of chaos ideas coming into the mainstream cinema. And it hasn't stopped. If anything, it's only intensified.
Absolutely. Yeah, I cover a lot of that at my site as well. One of the things I deal with a lot is Ian Fleming, who created the character James Bond. James Bond is one of the most iconic images from Hollywood in the last century. And I talk so much about James Bond and Ian Fleming, I don't want to dwell on that. But around that same time period, you had Hitchcock making a lot of films, obviously one of the most prominent directors of all time. And you'll find in early Hitchcock films a lot of that same, what's called German Expressionism in the history of cinema, that dealt a lot openly with not just Masonic imagery, but satanic imagery. So this goes all the way back to, we've all heard of Fritz Lang's Metropolis, and you know, we've got satanic imagery there. But I think that you're right, because Masonry is useful in that it's a network. And so there's always been a close relationship between espionage or intelligence agencies, Freemasonry as a secret society, and acting. Actors have been spies for centuries, precisely because it's all about lying and the trafficking secrets and playing a different role. And so if you look at, say, like my analyses of Hitchcock films, you'll see that Hitchcock has all those themes in his movies. If you look at North by Northwest, if you look at Vertigo, all these same things are there. All seeing eyes, you'll see in Spellbound, for example. If you look at the way Hitchcock deals with Jimmy Stewart's character. Jimmy Stewart was actually working for the FBI, as did Cary Grant. They both spied for the FBI. Cary Grant might have even worked for the OSS, the predecessor to the CIA. So this has been going on for a long time. And
Elvis worked for the DEA.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a great point.
And see, it's this whole interrelationship between the power and the influence. Now, the power is what you don't see. The influence is what you do see. If you have an actor in front of the screen, they're not the person with any power. It is the producer whose name you don't know behind the scenes who is the executive producer out of the six executive producers on a single film. Now, who's the real executive on this film project? Who are the media interviewing for the film promotions? Are they interviewing the six executive producers about it? No, they're interviewing the big-name director, the big-name producer or whatever, the smokescreen for the hidden hand behind the agenda.
Absolutely. I mean, there's been, for, again, the earliest days of Hollywood, you look at the Cotton Club murders, for example, you got ties into the mafia. And that would be different mafias. It would be Italian mafia, Jewish mafia, Irish mafia, as well as the intelligence agencies. And so these apparently different entities, as you're saying, are all kind of like an interlinked network, a fabric, if you will. So they all play together in like a big evil version of a mural or something, right, to play their role. And there's just so many examples of this. I was thinking of something more recent. If you look at Argo, for example, Ben Affleck's, what I believe is a propaganda film, that's openly made with consultation and aid from the CIA. It's based on Antonio Mendez's book, Master of Disguise, who's one of the CIA's top disguise men. So there's no, again, you mentioned earlier the big blockbusters. Well, just think about in the last few years, we've had American Sniper, we've had Zero Dark Thirty. These are open CIA propaganda films that are really there to promote American militarism. We get this idea that the whole Hollywood's just liberal.
Well, let's not forget 13 Hours of Michael Bay's one.
Oh, 13 Hours.
I mean, which actually, boom, like right in front of your face. Like, it's just so blatant propaganda, you know?
Yeah, right. I mean, it's unreal. In fact, I even did analysis of the recent Star Trek film, which if you watch that movie, it's the third reboot now of the exact same story. So three times now we've had this guy who doesn't want to go along with the Federation, aka the UN Global Order. And what is he? He's a terrorist because he wants his nation or tribe or group or people to be independent. So naturally he's a terrorist and he wants to blow everybody up. In the new movie, it's Yorktown. He wants to blow up New York. So, I mean, it's so absurd on its face, the propaganda, once you're able to see it. But there's absolutely no question in my mind that, I mean, if you look at the history of Star Trek, Gene Roddenberry had connections to the Esalen Institute, a total mind control cult, and worked in tandem with actual MKUltra doctors and Aldous Huxley. If you look at the connections to the RAND Corporation, a big, huge globalist, one of the top globalist think tanks in the history of the world, also under the aegis of the Air Force, created by the Air Force, just like NASA, they worked in tandem with the creation of Star Trek. So there was kind of a symbiotic relationship between the producers and people who worked on Star Trek and the RAND Corporation. That sounds crazy, but you can actually find solid research on that. So I talk about that. I talk about, you know, all of these different levels, as well as the esoteric. You mentioned, you know, the Masonic stuff, and I'm glad you said that because, that actually gets, believe it or not, I do a lot of interviews and that gets looked over. Like, people are always talking about all this other stuff and you forget, well, actually there's like masonry everywhere in movies. I mean, it's insane.
It's the most prominent thing. It's quite funny, actually. There's this running gag in my house, and when my wife likes to watch a lot of TV shows and things like that, but I prefer to watch a lot of movies. And I'll walk past her, I'll walk past her door or something like that, and there'll just be like this Vinny walking past your door, Masonic floor, you know, Masonic floor, All Seeing Eye Pyramid, just this voice in the background walking past, and then and there's the Masonic imagery. So it's happening that often that literally at a glance of what other people are watching, you can tell that there's Masonic influence. That's how blatant it is, right? Now, when I explained this to Suzanne Posel, OccupyCorporatism.com. She was like, oh, Vinny, I don't really get it. I don't really get it. And I go, no, just keep watching. Keep watching. And I'm keep going down. Screenshot after screenshot after screenshot after screenshot. And after maybe the 3rd minute, she's starting to get bored. And it's like, oh, and maybe 8 minutes, she's like, oh, my God, I want to get out of here. It's terrible. But by maybe the 10th or 12th minute, the penny drops. How many different films, how many different genres, how absolutely freaking absorbed the entirety of the filming and television industry is just lathered like a shaving cream with Masonic imagery and themes, right? Order out of chaos, right? 33rd degree motto is auto ab chaos, order out of chaos. Now, as soon as I say those words, if you pay attention when you're watching films, you will see those words repeated many, many times. Even at the end of Captain America, The Winter Soldier, where the guy's talking to the Winter Soldier, he's saying that society's between a tipping point between order and chaos, and so on and so forth, and it's in all the films, right? Now, when it's undeniable, and yet gets glossed over, as you pointed out in a lot of interviews, its influence starts to scare me a little bit more, because not only is it so ever-present that it's always everywhere, but it's so freaky and sort of occulted in people's awareness of it. You know, people don't know, even though it's right in front of their face. That's the trick. That's how you get people on a subliminal level. You can only really program people and influence them if they aren't aware of the symbols, if they aren't aware of the programming. Information, being informed, is your only defense against it.
Absolutely. You know, I was running through different thoughts in my head about examples that we might not have touched on or that I haven't touched on in other interviews, and I'm reminded of so many people, especially A-list, or Hollywood royalty maybe that we might call them, that they actually come from prominent families, and presumably it would be families of long Masonic pedigree, as well as quite often families of intelligence or military intelligence pedigree. So, for example, if you look at Natalie Portman, her grandmother, if I recall, was a spy for British intelligence. Now, that may sound strange, but there's so many examples of this when you really start researching it. If you take the case of Jennifer Garner, well, after she does this predictive programming spy show called Alias, where she's got multiple personalities and all this mind control MK Ultra type stuff, she openly goes to work for the CIA, openly as a PR person. Now, it's hard to believe, but if you read Trisha Jenkins' book on the Hollywood and the CIA, she talks about the consultation of the CIA even back on Alias. So it's almost like sometimes the roles are written for people to later become what they were in fiction. And so I talk about this a lot at my site. So I would venture to guess that a lot of the big A-listers, especially people like George Clooney or Angelina Jolie, that have an important role in the Council on Foreign Relations publicly, I mean, I would say that they have to be CIA. Ben Affleck, you know, gives interviews and says Hollywood is full of CIA agents. There was a book written by Philip Rizzo about the connection between the CIA and different directors and the drug trade. So here's a guy writing a whole book about it openly. So it's an open secret. And yeah. So this is, I think, the real reason that why we see so much craziness in Hollywood is that you've got cults. Think about Kabbalism, right? The Kabbalah, that's everywhere in Hollywood, right? And that's very similar in many ways to Masonry. Many Masons are Kabbalists. Look at Albert Pike's book, Morals and Dogmas, full of Kabbalism. You've got intelligence families and backgrounds. All the people, if you read Dave McGowan's Laurel Canyon book, all the Hollywood A-listers of the 60s and 70s, well, they're all in cults. Some of them are Crowleyans, some of them are Masons, some of them are, you know, Children of God, Manson cults. It all ties in. And we always find in the background, I would say even above the Masonic level, we always find these intelligence agencies that are back there, and particularly military intelligence that I think function as kind of the real Illuminists, so to speak.
Mm. They use this term predictive programming a lot on shows exposing this, and yet the term itself is not very well understood by the people who've heard the term before. Have you noticed that? Like, you'll sit there and you'll watch something that you know to be predictive programming, unknowing that it's actually predictively programming you and what you're prepared to accept in the future, right? I had this really strange and scary thought. Like, I was sitting there and I was like, man, I'm thinking, wouldn't it be really cool if we were in this high-tech society, right? With all the gadgets, all the post-human advances, with the implanted microchips in the brain, with the holographic, fully interactive software, right? And nobody really had to go anywhere or do anything. You'd have this perfect artificiality that'd be really interesting and fun to live in for a while. But then once you start to realize that there are limits to this holographic projection thing and that the only things that are, shall we say, liberating or freeing in that society aren't fucking real, that's when I started to realize that that's the society that we're already fucking living in.
Exactly. Have you ever heard of that?
None of the shit that really means anything that we're told really has any value in society. It isn't real. It doesn't have any value.
Have you ever heard of The Matrix? I'm just joking.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen The Matrix? I make that argument. I say, people always talk about the New World Order is coming. I'm like, it's here. We live in a Disney gulag. It's now. Like, that is the gulag. The New World Order is you going to Disney. It's like living in the Hollywood fantasy realm. And I'm not saying you can't watch movies and enjoy them. I mean, I do. But the synthetic that you're talking about, that's what I was getting at earlier. That is the New World Order is that synthetic simulacrum. There's a great essay it's a full book, Simulacra and Simulation by Jean Baudrillard, who's a famous philosopher, who that was his whole critique of modernity is that actually it all leads to techno-nihilism or tech-nihilism, I call it, which is just completely immersing oneself. And that's what it's actually going to be eventually is this, implantable. You're going to be hooked up to the Matrix, basically. And a lot of people will go for that. But, I don't think that that'll ultimately be successful because, I mean, it's just so abnormal. It's so unnatural to who we are as humans and how we've lived for thousands of years that I just don't see how that could fully take place. But nevertheless, they will try.
Not in isolation, but if it's in concert, if there's multiple ways to keep you in the alternate world as your escapism, then it's quite possible, I think. For example, if you say, I really don't like this holographic scheme. It's really bad. Okay, well, we've got a drug for that. And if you take too much of that drug because you really, really don't like reality, that drug will kill you. Right? That's the thing. Or if you step out of the program in public and all of a sudden you start acting strange, like not the way you're supposed to, you'll have somebody, maybe even friends, family, just all of a sudden, what are you doing, bro? What are you doing? Like, everybody will be hooked in, and it'll be a total panopticon, but a mobile, internal panopticon. Like, you will be your own guard against any original thought. Now, that was the thought that actually really scared me, because I found that kind of idea attractive for a second. Right? You take away the responsibilities. You take away the actual struggle of life itself just for a moment, just so that you can get a relief from it. That's why the entertainment industry and the movie industry, I think, is getting now bigger than it ever has before, because more and more, as the jackboot comes down on people's throat, they are going to the movies in droves. Billion-dollar films now. Billion-dollar films. Right? To escape the really fucking horrible reality that they are faced with on a daily basis.
Yeah, that escapism, there's actually some of the big I guess you could say they're psychiatrists, but a lot of the guys that worked in MKUltra, like Jose Delgado or Gordon Wasson or other CIA-type thinkers like Gregory Bateson, they actually wrote books where they talked about how the key to all of this, to mind control, was the capturing of the imagination, right? So it's not just, you know, grabbing somebody and putting them in a chair and strapping them down and, you know, like Alex in Clockwork Orange or something. It's more so about capturing people's imaginations. And the best way to do that is through fantasy. And so I'm not saying I'm very much pro fantasy. I like Tolkien, C.S. Lewis, all that kind of stuff. But when it's turned to being weaponized, and I really do think modern fantasy is being weaponized. And that's why we see so many bizarre manifestations of people, grown men thinking that they're My Little Ponies. I mean, this is like a real trend in the U.S. I'm not making that up for people who've never heard of bronies. I mean, and so there's all this cosplay stuff that's getting so popular everywhere, and furries, right? We even saw that in The Shining. There was like a scene with the furry giving fellatio. I mean, this kind of stuff is, it's all about the retreat into the into fantasy and escapism that you talked about. And there's actually a famous sci-fi novel by Tad Williams that actually deals with that very theme. It's written prior to the Matrix movie, but there were other books actually that came out, like William Gibson's Neuromancer, that dealt with the same theme of the Matrix, this, you know, synthetic realm that you plug into in your head. But Tad Williams' book Otherland actually deals with this, like, wars and battles that go on in the mental realm, the fantasy realm of the of virtual reality. And I mean, regardless of whether we get to that realm or that stage in the process, we're in the virtual reality now. I mean, even with the internet, I mean, I'm not a huge fan of the internet, because on the one hand, yeah, there's pros, there's a lot of good stuff, but it's also given by the Pentagon to be a mass surveillance social engineering tool. And so that's why we see so many weird trends pop up in the internet, like memes. I mean, memes are everywhere now, and this is all about, I did a recent show with Clyde Lewis where memes are all about mind control. So I mean, you have it straight from the mind control doctors themselves. Gregory Bateson, he says all we got to do is capture their imagination with something like, we're going to give you, you know, transhumanist immortality, we'll stick you in a vat and plug you up to a matrix and you'll be a god in your own little world forever. None of that's actually going to manifest. They're not going to give you that. They want you to die. And if you do get plugged into the vat, you're there to be some kind of, you know, science experiment. So, you know, it's mad science land is what it is.
Mm. And it's a total saturation of it. It's the only way it can work, really, is if everybody's tapped into that exact same sick culture. Mm-hmm. And that's what the real threat of globalism, I think, to me, is that there won't be any distinction. Like, you'll come to New Zealand and you'll see the same program that you see in Australia. I remember one time Max Egan came in and I picked him up at the airport and smoked a joint with him. And then we're driving through the suburbs, right? And he's just going like, fuck me, it's exactly the same as Australia, mate. And it's just like that, isn't it? There's really no difference wherever you go around the world, that one monoculture, and that's getting rid of the national sovereignty. And because all of these things are individually working, right, they don't actually need the rest of the machine to function. They operate independently, but they also seem to operate in concert, right?
Yeah.
If three people were told, go stab that guy, and the guy's all of a sudden stabbed at the same time by three people who didn't know that there were two other people who got given the same order, You think, man, that's really random, right? What a freaking coincidence. Unbeknownst that there were the exact same objective being given from three different directions, right? That's the concept. That's the beauty of it. It's like, it's an infinite loop, okay? Like in Inception, when you draw a paradox that goes in a circle, that is how you get an establishment to perpetuate itself. It goes in a circle. Everything goes back to the center and then comes back round again, much like a toroidal field.
Mobius strip of monstrosity.
Yeah, the Mobius monstrosity. There we go. I kind of like that idea. So this is how you can perpetuate an idea and destroy an entire society in every single way, brick by brick, by making sure that every conspiracy, every ring feeds back in on itself, and every ring interlocks with another one somewhere along the chain. And that way, nobody would ever actually be able to break the entire machine. They'd only be able to break an individual ring, which would just replace itself quickly. That's brilliant.
Yeah, and it really is that planned out, that strategically. I mean, you look at the geopolitical setting, it's the same way with the way American bases are all over the globe. I mean, there's no one place that you could take over and, you know, limit, I say America, but it's actually the Western Atlanticist power block. I mean, there's no way that you could really take it down by, say, one movement of nationalism. You know, if nationalism took over some country over in Eastern Europe or something, that would not affect the grid, you know, that the NORTHCOM, CENTCOM, USCOM, SOUTHCOM, AFRICOM, that, you know, that the establishment has placed all over the globe. And so it really has to be, you know, individual by individual, you know, waking up and using critical thinking. And it can't happen through any kind of, in my view, I mean, I'm not saying politics is totally useless, but a lot of people are operating, if they try to be really politically active. And I was really, you know, in my 20s, I was all into activism. And then you kind of get a little bit cynical when you get into your 30s, because you realize, oh, by about the fourth or fifth presidential election that rolls around, you're like, the same motherfuckers that it's the Clintons and the right. It's like, this is not real. And then you get cynical, but then you can actually, I think, grow out of that phase of cynicism, and you realize, well, actually, you can affect people at a more local level, you know, to get on the positive side of things. But, you know, I'm not totally cynical or have a totally negative view of this. I think that it's very possible. It's just, I don't know.
People put too much responsibility on their own shoulders, bro. You know, like, I'm going to go out and I'm going to teach the world about this, or teach the world about that, or I'm going to change this or that or the other. And it's like, dude, no. You could change an individual, but you wouldn't actually be the person that changed them. They would be the one that changed themselves. You would only be the one to impart something as a gift to them that you wouldn't even receive back, right? That's the real clincher to that cynicism and that jaded feeling that I had, is stop having an emotional attachment to getting back what I give.
That's a great point.
Yeah. And on that note, ladies and gentlemen, donate to the Vinnie Eastwood Show at the vinnieeastwoodshow.com, because I've been, mate, these last couple of weeks, I've been really, really, like, busting my ass, making really good videos with new green screen backgrounds and the whole nine yards. And it has been a lot of work. And the cat's sick, and he, like, has got this really expensive, like, medical, like, food that he needs to eat. It's like $25 for a box of, like, 14 of them. And he's a big cat, so he eats a hell of a lot of it. It's freaking ridiculous. Cat eats almost as much as I do. Maybe it's because he's ginger. I don't know. But we also need extra hard drive space. My external drives are nearly full up. That means I will not be able to do these shows in the near future, within the next one or two episodes, if I do not have some coin in the accounts for those extra hard drives as well, ladies and gentlemen. The VinnieEastwoodShow.com is the place to go to donate and support my little operation here. Nobody can do everything, but everybody can do something. My very special guest is Jay Dyer, and we will be right back after the break at AmericanFreedomRadio.com. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, because there is only one Vinnie Eastwood. It's me. I'm the freaking best interviewer in the world. And I've got the worst puns to boot. Like, bro, you just can't go wrong. Every time that you listen to this show, you will change as a person. I know, because I host this show and I listen to my guests. And every single time I have a guest on the show who's good at what they do, they all tell me the same kind of story, and they all have the same kind of view of reality. And I've come to know it as the one truth, right? And I didn't know what to call it, because the one truth, this word, has been hijacked by organized religion. All right, go Google the one truth. Guess what you find? A whole bunch of religious websites who all hate each other. can't disagree about what that one truth is and won't back down about what their interpretation of it is. But here's what the one truth is. Most of the things that you've been told are a lie, and the only thing that really exists is the one, is you, right? Because you're the only thing that you can move around. You're the only thing that you can will into action. It is you. You've got a massive responsibility. Knowing that, and knowing that the universe works in mysterious ways, and that if you be you and do not compromise, do exactly what you feel you must do, all these little synchronistic occurrences will start happening in your life to allow you to keep doing it. They don't start popping up all of a sudden to help you start doing what you really want to do with your life. You have to start amidst critique, amidst trauma, amidst pain, and amidst loss to be who you are, first and foremost. Only then, despite those odds, and you do it anyway, will little elements of help start to come to you that you didn't even ask for. You just needed them, and there they were, in the exact amount and at the exact time that you needed them. That's what all these people have been telling me. And that's the one truth that I myself have found in doing what I'm doing. My very special guest is Jay Dyer. Welcome to the show again for the second hour.
Vinny, if I come down there, is there going to be Kiwis at McDonald's?
No, that's an Australian accent. You see,
I know.
Australians.
Have you seen Flight of the Conchords?
I have.
They keep insulting with the Australian accent.
Yeah. It's a pen and a pin. You ever pin something on a donkey? You ever written something with a pen? In Australia, that word is the same. It's a pen. All right? That's all it is. The I and the E become synonymous. And instead of using the word, the letter H, they pronounce it H, which we do not do in New Zealand because of the anti-H speech laws.
I'm just fucking around.
So am I. Now, this is what people do, isn't it? If you're sitting there being all serious, have you noticed, bro, there's all these fucking serious truthers out there, right? They literally don't know how to have a laugh. They don't know how to have a joke. And it's like, what are you fighting for, bro? What are you living for? Okay, what kind of better tomorrow are you bringing about here? One that is free from song? One that is free from dance? One that is free from laughter? Hell no, bro. Okay? Imagine one day you're fighting, and you've been fighting for years, and you suddenly forget what you're fighting for. Right? You have to take time off occasion to just, you know, absorb some of the shit that you hear, man. It's dark stuff, and if you don't counterbalance it with, you know, fun and enjoying life, you'll lose your way, I think.
Yeah, I do a lot of impersonations. I got a bunch of videos on that if anybody wants to check those out. But yeah, there's about 20 or 30 impersonations I've done. So I try to keep it fun. I do Alex Jones, mock Alex Jones shows with various guests, Jeff Goldblum, Nick Cage, you name it. So I'm all about the comedy, man. I used to do stand up, so.
But now we're sitting down.
I had to think for a minute. I didn't get it at first, but
yeah.
Anyway, so what's up?
Well,
what now? What do we do now?
Well, here's the thing. We're talking about this concept of the contemporary, right? If you have people that are sort of on your level of intelligence, of sophistication, of kind of like thought processes, and the amount of progress you can make together when you discuss something that you're both curious about but you both know a little bit about simultaneously. It's like if you got two people who know a machine working on it together, they make a very interesting job of it, don't they? And that's what a lot of the interviews have really turned into. They're a conversation, you know? And the things that I prefer in conversations is the one that actually really means something to the person that I'm having a conversation with, something that actually strikes them at a very personal level.
Well, you're the number one conversationalist in the world, right?
Allegedly.
So the internet memes say.
Yeah. Okay, so think about this. If you have that penny drop moment, and when you have it, you know how you go through the grief process? You deny, you bargain, you get depressed, and then eventually you accept it and you start to make progress, right? Mm-hmm. What was it? How long did that take for you? Because for me, it took years, you know, and I think I'm still going through it to a degree. I'm not sure if I'll ever arrive at acceptance completely.
Right. Well, I mean, I did acid when I was 18. I had a bad trip and it really freaked me out. And that was kind of my break with, I guess, the way that I previously thought about things. And I got really religious. I got really into evangelicalism for a period in my 20s. And that was also driving me crazy. So I eventually exited that, and I spent most of my 20s really just diving into all of these books that you see surrounding me. And I have a life, so it's not like I just read books, but I have dated a girl. Now you're fake laughing. Is that a real laugh?
It really is real. Oh, God. That was good.
But a lot of those books, like in my early 20s, they were conspiracy related. And at the same time, I was studying philosophy, and conspiracy made a lot of sense with philosophy in the sense that you're questioning why are things the way they are? Why is the American government based on this Enlightenment experiment? Why do other countries have monarchies? What about secret societies? What about this? What about that? And it really is a long kind of alchemical process, I guess is one way you could put it, that you actually do go through, because you go through stages and you kind of blown away at first. Especially, I heard you in an interview talking about, you know, you watched some stuff on 9/11, you watched Michael Moore's thing, and I think I was watching Alex Jones videos, you know, back in 2004 or 2005, and I was like, whoa, you know, there's actually something to this. And you know, you break out of that. If I grew up a Republican, a dumb Baptist Republican, You break out of that mold and you start thinking otherwise, and you have a lot of conflict, you know, like you go and you talk to your family members and you're like, man, this Bush is not a good guy. And so you're going to get a lot of tension right away, and then that causes frustration and blah, blah, blah. And you just eventually, I think when you get out of your 20s, in my case, you know, I'm in my 30s, I got a lot more confident and okay with disagreeing with people. And if people don't listen, it doesn't matter. Who cares? There's a million freaking other people on the internet that will listen. So I don't have to worry about, you know, this or that guy. If they want to stay in their bubble, then they can stay in their bubble. That's their decision. But yeah, once you grow past those negative stages and you're not dealing with all the haters. I remember when I started blogging and writing about 8 or 9 years ago, it seemed like there was a lot of opposition. There was a lot of people, you know, just constantly calling you out, calling you crazy, calling you stupid, whatever. And then, you know, after a while, it's like, oh, actually, you know, you've been talking about this stuff for 10, 12 years. It's starting to come true. Yeah, you get a little bit of street cred, I guess. And, you know, people will listen to you. People, you know, you learn, I guess, you up your people skills. I mean, you're good at interviewing people. You've been doing it for a while. I'm sure that aided in your people skills, even beyond being a sales guy. I mean, I was a sales dude, too. And doing a lot of interviews, it's, you know, that helps you in conveying the message and dealing with people, basically.
For me, it was retooling. Sales was about getting somebody to say something I wanted, and interviewing is about getting the guest to say something that they want.
Yeah, it's a good way to put it. Yeah, yeah, you were definitely in sales. I can tell.
Well, what was it? The biggest realization for sales for me was, how do you create an impression and a bond with somebody in 30 seconds?
I think we had an AT&T class that was that very thing.
See?
create a bond in 30 seconds, find out all the details of that person, you know, let them talk, listen, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. See, I never had a manual. I never had a teacher. I had to learn by doing call after call how to actually communicate who I was and in a non-threatening way, you know, in 30 seconds and get who they are and what they actually need. And by the end of the conversation, actually have made a new friend, right? This, you know, unbeknownst to me, I was being trained, right, to be essentially an evil cog in a wheel to make money for a soulless corporation that was full of scumbags, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, thankfully, that lesson that I learned during that job has enabled me to really get people to open up quite quickly on the radio, unlike any other, you know, talk show host that is around. I remember this one time I had, maybe a few drinks and had a mate with me, and there were these two old Maori veterans. One was a veteran from World War II, one was a veteran from Desert Storm. And they told me stories about their friends dying in their arms, about killing like 42 men, you know, that kind of thing, and feeling like they've been in jail for 42 years. Something that they haven't even told their closest family members. Some stories that they haven't even told anybody in years. And after 35 minutes having a conversation with me, that's what I can get out of them. Now, it occurred to me that this is an incredible power. And just like every power, you have to give that power away immediately. All power that you contain within you burns you. It's like fire. Okay? If you get the fire, then you burn something, and then you can radiate its warmth. But if you've got a whole lot of power and you use it to manipulate and keep that into yourself, it only burns you up, and then there's nothing left. And that's what I saw happening to all the other people on my floor. I just watched them just unemotionally, uncaringly making these calls. And I remember one time I had a conversation with a guy who was just broken up with his wife, had his kids taken off of him. She took his business as well. You're right. So he had no kids, no wife, no home, no business. And he was just an absolute, he was asking me like a telesalesman, what do I do, man? What do I do? And I was trying to help him and everything like that. Like the sales thing just went right out the door. And after I hung up that call, man, I just went into the bathroom and just like bawled, just cried my eyes out, that kind of thing. Nobody else.
When did you leave the phone sex business?
I think it was in 2008 was my very, very last kind of sales job, but I stopped doing telemarketing and sales maybe in 2006. It was just kind of that transition period where you start to realize everything's wrong. And just like you did, you start to go through these different avenues. No, that's bullshit. No, that's bullshit. Fuck, you waste a bit of time where, waste a bit of time there. And then finally, boom. It's the people who are searching and are willing to fuck up and then get on their feet again. Those are the people who find out who they really are.
Yeah, I wouldn't have thought I would write a book. That's not something that was on my mind in my 20s. And then, you know, you just go and you start hammering away at what you like to do. I liked movies, and I thought, well, actually, there's so much message. There's so many embedded messaging and themes and narratives that actually apply to not just philosophy, but reality, politics, geopolitics, history, whatever. And you can show that through film. And so what I tried to do in my book was I wrote, I think, 120 film reviews, and they ended up getting, I don't know, a couple million views over the last couple of years. And I took the best 20 of those, 25 of those, put them in a book, and I did it with the intention of how can I take everybody's favorite movies and get them to read about it and wake up that way, right? So I think it's a good tool, and it's going to be a good tool for people who... I mean, it's not too academic. I mean, I'm dealing with, you know, James Bond movies and Kubrick movies and things like that, David Lynch movies. And everybody's seen those, and Spielberg movies, and using those as ways to say, well, this is how you can actually understand the way the real world works, right? I mean, you might take some goofy movie, something from H.G. Wells, The Time Machine or something like that, but you can actually see how, well, this actually shows how
science, quote unquote, the scientific establishment, the academic establishment, programs us through these kinds of things. Like, I believe H.G. Wells is a big time propagandist. He was a Fabian socialist, all about depopulation, all about collectivism, Marxism, communism. And he wrote that into all of his stories, and they're some of the most popular science fiction of all time. And so you can take those stories, those film versions, and you can show people, hey, this is how the world actually works. You don't believe in conspiracies? Well, here's a whole bunch of freaking movies that you love that everybody's seen, and they all deal with real conspiracy theories. I mean, all the James Bond stories are based in some real-world black operation that Ian Fleming knew about firsthand. He was a high-level naval psyops guy.
The CIA, there was a director one time, he said, once our disinformation campaign is complete, nothing the American public will believe is true, or words to that effect. It'll be the opposite of the truth. Then we'll know it's complete. Yeah. And there's a lot of myths that come through movies that are just sort of saturating society now. And I see climate change getting pushed quite a lot. I see globalism getting pushed quite a lot, you know, aside from the Masonic stuff. But the thing about film that interests me more than all other mediums above art, above just talk radio in and of itself, it incorporates as many artistic disciplines and can create the strongest emotional response out of any medium, right? Other than
did
maybe
you read my book? It's in there. That's in there.
Well, there you go. And aside from seeing a live band, all right, aside from seeing a live band, you cannot get a stronger when it's done correctly, you can get the strongest emotional response. You can get the strongest memory imprint, the impression down onto people. That was why I always wanted to be a filmmaker. That is why I'm making films now, is because I've realized that there's a lot of power and influence in this, and that all that power and influence is being used for currently is to convince people of things that are BS, to usher them into a society that doesn't care about them. What if films were made by an independent studio, big blockbuster films, with very small, multi-talented, skilled crews, with their own gear and that kind of thing, that they're actually kind of putting into it, and coming away with the greatest films of all time, without Masonic imagery, without pushing some kind of BS agenda, while actually exposing the truth and creating a new consciousness stream through the most powerful form of entertainment in existence, the blockbuster film. That'd be cool. And also, a conspiracy breakdown of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. From Iron Man all the way till today, all the conspiracy references and everything in that. Because when in 2008, when I was first starting to wake up, really, really wake up, and I watched Iron Man, and I saw all the references with the weapons being sold to the terrorists and things of that nature, and the industrial espionage and the censored military technology, and the putting BS about it, saying that it's a training exercise, and it's like ping, 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 and it lead me to suspect that there was perhaps at one point possibly an element within the Marvel team that wanted to sort of expose the New World Order, maybe Stan Lee's influence because of his really bad foray with Hillary Clinton. He like donated a whole bunch of money and then she screwed him or something like that. I don't know if you've heard of that story, but yeah.
Well, Shane Black is who wrote a couple of those more conspiracy, as well as Joss Whedon, wrote a couple of those more conspiratorial Marvel films. If you look at Iron Man and the way that it exposed Bin Laden as an actor, which everybody in the conspiracy world has known in some degree for a good while now. Well, Shane Black did Long Kiss Goodnight, which was not that great of a movie, but it did explicitly show MK Ultra mind control. That's the whole point of that movie. So, I think that you do have people at times that seem to want to get some degree of truth out. Certainly, I did analyses of all those, as well as Winter Soldier. And
especially Winter Soldier, you know, like if you're a truther and you haven't seen that.
Yeah, right. There's a lot of truth in that one for sure. So, yeah, I mean, I've always thought that I mean, making films is always what I wanted to do as well. So, you know, maybe one day, I didn't think I'd write a book. So did I, you know, you could do whatever you want to in this world. And I think that the new media that we're a part of is, you know, the stepping stone to great things.
Mm. It's becoming cheaper now. When yep. realistic CGI is available to the home consumer, just as now high quality HD video editing software is available to the home consumer through Apple products or whatever now.
Right.
Once that is available, then you will have independent blockbusters that have maybe a couple of $1 million budget and can maybe make $1 billion at the box office because it's that good, it's that enthralling, and everybody on the project actually put a hell of a lot of time and effort of it for years of voluntary work to make the effects that good because they had the technology to be able to do it. Much like we now have the technology to do reasonably good quality newscasts from home to compete with the mainstream media. It's just that one step. It's just like when James Cameron was talking about making Avatar back in the early 90s, and he said, no, not yet. The technology's not quite there to produce the realism that I want. That's what I'm waiting for in the film industry. I think that'll be huge.
So what are you making the life story of Vinnie Eastwood?
No, I mean, I remember one story. What was it? Jim Carrey was giving a valedictorian speech to like a university or something, and he said that the key to success in life is just having that one impossible dream and just do one thing every day that's moving in that direction, and eventually you get there. Right? So if I put the intention out there, if I do my editing skills all the time, if I'm always making my videos just a little bit better with a little bit of tweaking, with a little bit of color correction, with a little bit of this, that, and the other, eventually I'll become so much of a skilled technician when it comes to film editing and filmmaking in general that I might be able to cut together something the caliber of a feature film, theoretically, at some point. I don't know.
So you're going to do a documentary?
Well, yeah, that's already on the cards. I've got a whole bunch of interviews that I've already got in the can. I've got about half the script done for it. It's just finding the time to do it when I've already got this radio show to do with all the editing that entails, you know. it's a bitch, but I'll find the time, you know. If you don't make time, you can never have it. Sorry, by the way, I'm rambling. Now, we talked about the Winter Soldier there for a second, and I wanted to get this because I was just questioning, how can you put something that's that obvious a snub to the New World Order in your film and have it be as successful as it was, I mean, without it getting scuttled or anything? Or is it possibly that predictive programming sort of thing? Like, the truth's so close to coming out that they just had to, they could just put it out there, and then all of a sudden everybody's like, oh, okay, the wave kind of crashes.
I think sometimes the establishment throws a bone to the people. I think they do that with political candidates, and we see this with the furor and fervor for Trump. This gives people the impression that, oh, here's another, finally a hero, somebody we can put our time and energy into. And these people really just function as lightning rods to take all the time and energy that could be put into profitable things, into focusing everybody back into the useless political cycle of every 4 years. So without that throwing a bone to the people, I think that you might get people completely discontent and malcontent. People don't want to have anything to do with it. So they got to throw a bone at times. And I think that and it also could be, as I said, I mean, it's not always one thing. It could be a multitude of factors. I mean, Shane Black does conspiracy related stuff quite often, so that could be part of it.
Mm. Well, just the question of if you've got conspiracy stuff in the movies, I don't know. There's a whole lot of backstory to things and a whole lot of internal politics and reputations and massive egos in the industry as far as my research has come into, and how people make deals and make movies and things of that nature. It's a reason why Josh Hartnett doesn't get any work anymore, because he turned down a whole bunch of major roles because he just didn't want to do them. And then Hollywood basically, as a clique, got pissed off with him. And he's having a real hard time getting work. Now, it has that kind of self-protection system, much like high school does. When you're in high school and you do something out of the ordinary, or you do something that the teacher doesn't like, you get sent to the principal's office. Or if you do something nerdy or weird, you get your peers attacking you and stuff like that. And the entertainment industry, that's got these... it's sort of like this... pop-up resistance, right? Like Jim Carrey comes out and he does the all mocking tongue on the on the thing, and then right? Or Tila Tequila comes out and then rises in the media, and then Charlie Sheen comes out asking 20 questions with the president, and then right? There's a shushing mechanism of some description. Randy Quaid called them star whackers, where they'll actually kill stars that have enough influence to actually make a difference, right? That's how powerful Hollywood is, and that's how dangerous it is to operate at those levels.
Yeah, and if anybody doubts that as a possibility, just consider the things that we've been talking about the last hour and a half. I mean, you're dealing with an entity that's tied into the Pentagon, the military-industrial complex, and the intelligence agencies, as well as the mafia. So they have every means at their disposal to dispense with a person who goes off script. And I think that is what we see at times. Sometimes the big stuff that happens in the media, the kerfluffle of people doing this or that, or Amanda Bynes having a breakdown, or Britney having a breakdown, I mean, could that be their mind control program? Yeah, it could be. But it also could be that if you watch, there's a great documentary called Star Suckers, and it deals with how a lot of these things are created for PR. And that's another angle to this, is that it's all about just staying in the media, whether it's negative or positive attention. That can be good for album sales, movie sales, whatever. A lot of times marriages are arranged. My friends that do Hoaxbusters just did a great podcast on the history of Katy Perry, Miley Cyrus, and what's another one of these skanks? One of the big, anyway, Taylor Swift. We think of them as these people who rose to the top because of their talent, and that's not actually how it happens at all. These are people who rose to the top because they had a lot of money behind them, and so they all three come from exceedingly wealthy families. In fact, Miley Cyrus's granddad was a Federal Reserve Bank chairman, I believe. Katy Perry's family, they're oil magnates. So the role of the star is a created consumer product, and it often has millions and millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars, behind it. So their lives are very controlled. I mean, if you read the history of Marilyn Monroe, she was basically under house arrest for most of her life by her handlers and people at the studios. If you watch that recent Coen Brothers movie, Hail Caesar, you kind of get an image of that handler character played by Josh Brolin, which is not that great of a film, but excellent in illustrating that point, as well as the stage nature of the Cold War. But yeah, I mean, it's really the reality of Hollywood is also very much theatrics. And yeah, people that get out of line can be whacked, I believe. Sure.
Okay. Because I do want to think about how it is possible for just like the truth movement's done to the mainstream media, I want the truth movement to do to the mainstream entertainment industry. Okay, I want truther relevant music. You know, I want truther relevant art. I want truther relevant TV shows. You know, not just about the information and everything, but I actually want to be entertained, but I want to have something that's really deep entertaining, something that actually touches me on an emotional level and makes me think about who I am as a person. That kind of artwork in terms of a TV show, something that's really intelligent, something that actually speaks to the nature of what it is to be human. This is the original concept of why filmmaking became an art form, I believe, is to offer insight onto the human condition. And I don't believe it's doing that to a sufficient quantity to qualify.
No, I think you really only find the quality material that you're discussing in independent films. I think that you can still find that at times. But for the most part, what you're speaking of is applicable across the board to the blockbusters. I mean, all the blockbusters and the big studios are, you know, so in bed with the Pentagon and the existing establishment that they're not going to allow, you know, maybe here and there throwing the bone. They're not going to allow that. So, yeah, I mean, it's entirely possible. I mean, I think people nowadays do make independent films with good messages. They're just not that easy to find. They don't get the attention because that is the power of the existing octopus oligarch establishment that we have.
Mm, even to remove the documentary Vaxxed.
There you go.
From a whole lot of film festivals and things of that nature. So there's an active suppression going on, and we deal with the suppression all the time. And people like you and I, we have shows and websites because, in part, there were a lot of our elders that came before us that faced far more greater criticism and struggles than we did in the age before the internet. To lay the groundwork so that we can do this. And so we've got to struggle against whatever it is now, and maybe the next generation will be able to do a lot of these things that we dreamed was possible.
Yeah, what elders are you thinking of? Mormon elders?
No. People in the truth movement have been exposing truth and doing this kind of stuff for decades and decades, you know, like the G. Edward Griffins and Jordan Maxwells of this world, you know. Mm-hmm. They've kind of made what we're doing a lot easier because they've sort of softened it up. They were like the shock troops that went in to soften up the enemy before the light troop infantry went in after the barbed wire, you know.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. So, what was it? That old Greek quote: "The idea of life is to plant a tree whose shade you know you'll never get to sit underneath." And I think if we take that long view, right, the conspiracy currently works because whoever created it has took the long view about everything, yeah. And they wanted it to be multi-generational, and I think the only way to actually destroy it, I mean completely, will be with a counter-conspiracy that's just as complex.
Long-term.
And long-term, right? Like, we're talking about generations of resistance to eventually make a free humanity. I don't think you or I will live to see the day where humanity will be free from these tyrannical sociopaths. It's going to get worse, and it will be much worse than what we see today. But everything's getting better at the same time too, isn't it? Ironic.
Yeah, I've done a lot of research and talks on Brave New World by Aldous Huxley, and Huxley, I think, is the most accurate presentation of predictive programming in terms of where we're going. And Huxley describes everything from the synthetica that we talked about earlier to the genetic modification. And he described all that back in 1932 when he wrote the novel. So, and he was also obviously one of these, you know, top Royal Society big term planners. I mean, his family was part of that cadre, that cabal. And I think that when you really dig into these big tomes, Tragedy and Hope included, or the writings of Zbigniew Brzezinski, or any of the big globalist geopolitical thinkers, you see very clearly that they're thinking long term. Like you said, they've got the next 10, 20, 50 years planned out. Rand Corporation papers, white papers, they project things 20, 50 years ahead. All the big think tanks too, Brookings Institute, they plan things ahead, Rockefeller Foundation. So I think you hit the nail on the head with that. And the response, I believe, is that it requires more than just knowing information. I think that we actually have to have a complete worldview that includes like philosophy and critical thinking, and then passing that on to future generations. And so that's kind of what my site's centered around, is grounding in a stable worldview and a stable philosophy. And that's the way that we can ensure that future generations know how to recognize and reject absurdity, madness, mind control, and essentially everything that the world puts out as bait, right? I mean, I think it's, we live in, I mean, Plato's great for this because he, you know, this is the classic allegory of the cave, that, you know, what we're presented with is not reality, and we live in that dark cave. And one of the things that philosophy can help do is lead us out of that cave and to truth with a capital T, big ideal truth that you talked about earlier. And that's why I talk so much about, I do a whole lecture series, for example, on Plato's Republic, which is all about that. So that's what I'm all about.
Mm. The reshaping of society in a positive way over multi-generations, affecting every industry. And the first word that comes to mind when I think about a plan like that is get rid of the psychopaths. Just, where are all the psychopaths? At the very top of all the fucking institutions, aren't they? Where's all the power? With all the psychopaths at the very top of all these fucking institutions, aren't they? Is it not that simple?
It's pretty amazing. I mean, I know you said you kind of had a anti-religious perspective or agnostic sort of perspective, but I mean, to me, doesn't that seem like supernatural evil that all of the institutions are run by total wicked psychopaths?
Oh, yeah.
Or do you just see it as like an evolutionary thing, or do you see it as actual like evil?
I think it's three-pronged, right? Number one, if you're a psychopath who can lie convincingly and has no conscience, it gives you an unfair advantage in the workforce because you will sabotage your competition for any job that's available and you'll be the one to advance. And right. So on and so forth. And thus, once you're there, you'll be able to sabotage anybody who is competing for your position from below with much more power and effectiveness. They only crave the money and power and sex anyway, which is all the things that we're all told to crave. So you'll start to look up to them. Okay, so They become leaders. They become the owners or whatever. Now, what's worse is when you've got a psychopath that actually starts the institution and appoints themselves as the head of it, as opposed to, say, Rome, where the institution worked reasonably well to keep people in control, and psychopaths infiltrated it, took control of it, and eventually one psychopath became emperor and controlled everything, and then it became and it destroyed itself, right? So essentially, in terms of whether it's spiritual, I think that these entities have been here for a very, very long time, all right? And I think they own us. I think they're the farmers, we're the cattle. I really do think that because there's never been a point throughout history where I can point to where there's been any civilization where you look at the characteristics of the people who run that civilization, you look at the characteristics of that civilization collapses, and I see the exact same pattern the whole way throughout history. So that means whatever is in control of humanity, whatever a psychopath is, has an ability to hide itself inside a human host and be able to transmute itself, learn different languages, change its appearance over time, and still play the same scam without it being realized. It's an entity that hides in the shadows and hides inside and behind human beings in order for itself to feed and to grow. It needs destruction. It needs pain. It needs torture. It needs negative, low energy vibration fields. And if you have a look at all the inventions that are becoming now weaponized, that's the only thing that they're doing. They're centralizing power structure and they're exacerbating really low energy fields that are really bad for human beings, essentially. They're not high-frequency love pattern kind of stuff that you can get off the human heart when it's beaten with love, you know? It's a real nasty thing. And because it's beyond time, or at least one person's time on this earth. You can't just be here and then the conspiracy's reached its fruition at a certain point. it means that you can only think about time in essence of playing your part against it, that I am a cell in a body that has an expiration date, but I happen to be a white blood cell, and I'm trying to seek out the antibodies while I'm still here, right? Now, if all of us that can be the white blood cells to seek out and wipe out this viral parasite on humanity called the psychopathic entity, then we might have a chance. But it would take generations, essentially, to eventually weed them out. There'd have to be another way to hold humanity in check afterwards as well. Because when you have freedom, but you have no path, that freedom always ends up in licentiousness, and the psychopaths always take control. There's no inclination for people to better themselves in a society where all their freedom is handed to them, where there is no threat, where there is no rite of passage, where there is no danger, where the weak are held aloft as the pinnacle of achievement, where the strong are the ones who simply have the greatest burdens put upon them to support others. That's not the way it's supposed to work. It's supposed to be in concert, everybody with all their different strengths working together as one unit and being able to advance themselves in their own ways, right? Like an apprenticeship does. But there isn't any of that. It's all collectivization, which is, again, a hierarchical structure, which is, again, an archontic entity structure, which is, again, fucking up the entire human race throughout the entire course of history. So if history is to change fucking direction, we need to recognize the broad implications of an entity that can conceal itself throughout history and hide behind infinite masks and infinite institutions. Once you start to wonder about how you can face an enemy like that, then we might be able to come up with something.
Do you think those entities are conscious? Do you believe that they're equivalent to something like the demonic?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, essentially, it's the same difference. I mean, if you look at all the... at any writing, really, about demonic possession and these kind of things from ancient to today, then you have a look at the traits of a psychopath, which used to be in the DSM, and incidentally, they took out psychopathy from the mental illnesses section. They also just recently took out narcissism. Incidentally, did you know that all psychopaths are narcissistic? Guess who writes the Diagnostic Statistical Manual? You know, just take a stab in the dark, ballpark figure, don't worry. But
psychopaths.
Exactly. And I'm a narcissist, so I understand. I have a lot of these things that you would consider psychopathic traits, you know, that charm and so on and so forth, right? But I don't have their lack of empathy.
You do?
I've got a hyper amount of empathy. I don't have their lack of creativity. I've got a hyper amount of creativity. And so, although...
So you're saying you're an awesome psychopath with all the good qualities. Is that what you're saying?
Kind of like, you know how Blade is the Daywalker? All of the strengths of the vampires, but none of their weaknesses?
Do you also participate in role-playing? Do you do LARPing as well?
No.
I'm just messing with
you. No, but I was thinking about this, right? Have you seen the movie The Chronicles of Riddick? And yeah. In the opening scene, they say that with an evil like this, in times like this, evil would normally be fought by good. But unfortunately, the only thing we've got to fight it is another kind of evil. And I've thought about that sort of as a concept, you know, because I've got like emotional damage and things like that and PTSD or whatever, that I'm trying to be the good bad guy, right?
The anti-hero.
No, it's more like the damaged hero, right? Mm. Somebody who has a lot of pain and a lot of trauma and spends a good portion of their time when they could be trying to get over that pain and getting over that trauma, instead trying to ward others off so that they don't have to experience it kind of thing.
Clint Eastwood.
Yeah. You know, name your cliche. But it works in a similar way for many people, I think. Like Cindy Sheehan, for example. She had her son killed in an illegal war. And now she knows the pain of a mother losing her son. And she became an anti-war activist in the hopes that she could stop other mothers from losing their sons and experiencing the same pain that she had. Now, say what you will about psychopaths, the one good thing they are is about motivating people with a conscience, right? People with a conscience get fucked over by a psychopath, they get real pissed off about it, and they'll sometimes wait years and years, and they'll always be thinking about that motherfucker until one day you do a 23-minute video of their unauthorized biography of 30 years of all of their crimes, and they wind up in jail. That's right. I did that to Pete Santilli. That son of a bitch. You have no idea who Pete Santilli is, do you?
Oh, I know all about it.
Oh, good. But anyway, coming down to the last 10 minutes here.
I work with somebody who used to work with him, so I know all about it.
Yeah, he's go and have a look at my video, and then the unauthorized biography of Pete Santilli. Just when me and Suzanne Posel were making that, you ever made a video where you're exposing somebody's scumbaggery, and you're exposing it so concisely that you have to just stop every couple of seconds after of editing to just burst out laughing because it's so funny to you? You ever had that experience?
I've really only had one run-in with alternative media personages, and yeah, it was pretty funny.
Yeah,
so I know the feeling.
Now, this is something that was told to me about. It's a game, okay? Who was it? Gordon Bowden. He's figured out the scams that are being run out of Masonic lodges, where they can create fake companies, get everybody to invest all their seed capital in it, get local politicians and celebrities to endorse these companies with media conferences and things like that, and then collapse them and say, oh, well, it was a risky investment, right? And I said to him, dude, you're getting calls off the hook. We had this incredible call where there was maybe about six things have to go right during a Skype call. You can hear me, I can hear you, vice versa, and blah, 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 blah. All these little technical things that have to go right for a call to work. And every single one of them systematically failed trying to interview this guy. And he's always getting stuff like that happen to him. And it's inexplicable. It never happened to me to that extent before in my life. And I asked him, how do you emotionally deal with this? I mean, you're going after these guys very directly. You're actually calling out their names, and you're filing documents in court, and they are actually talking to you and attacking you and that kind of thing. How do you see that dynamic working? He goes, well, it's a game. All right, it's a game. I'm just having fun, you know? I was like, whoa. Now, Doctor Who, that is who laughs in the face of a really bad threat, right? Somebody told me that one time. That's how you maintain your self-discipline when you're surrounded by enemies, when you're up against the impossible, is to laugh, isn't it?
Are you? Is this a subtle code that I'm your enemy? I'm lost. I'm joking.
I know.
Is there undertones here? Like, who's the enemy? Are you talking about Pete Santilli, the video you made?
No. That wasn't what I was saying at all. Just talking about how the New World Order is the enemy, right?
Okay.
And how it's such a big thing and a big threat, and it seems kind of like impossible to beat. And that's why you got to laugh. Otherwise, you'll go fucking nuts. That's what I was saying.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, it is funny when you have these sort of run-ins with other persons in, you know, the circles that you're dealing with alternative media and stuff like that. And it's kind of comical because it's sad, really. And I mean, I know in the case of what you're talking about, this is a person who obviously had connections to the government and the Fed and so, or being a Fed and so forth. But then when you also meet these people that really have, I think, kind of out of place egos for not being that big of a deal, right? I'm talking about the person that I had a run-in with. I mean, you know, we're still pretty much small time when it comes to media. And so to really have a big ego is just kind of out of place. And then if you actually talk to higher level persons in terms of status or prominence and so forth in whatever field,
a lot of times they don't have that attitude, right? So it tends to be kind of only the people that are in the middle sphere or people that you're interacting with that kind of get this inflated ego or outrageous, you know, incorrect self-image of what their influence really is. And it's kind of sad because it's, I think, as with the psychopath, it tends to be self-destructive. I mean, even if these people, it's like Hillary Clinton, I mean, she's obviously psychopathic. But I mean, it's not, where does that get you? I mean, so you're miserable and you hate everyone and most likely you hate yourself. I mean, if I was Bill Clinton or if I was her looking in the mirror, I would hate myself. I mean, she's disgusting. But so, I mean, what do you gain from that? It's like Jesus said, right? Like, what's that quote from the Bible of, you know, if you gain the whole world and lose your soul, like what was the point? It was useless.
People ask this question, how do they sleep at night? Well, it's because they don't have a conscience, sweetheart.
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, when you go to sleep, do you toss and turn and think about a whole bunch of stuff? Maybe the stuff that's pissing you off, maybe the stuff that's depressing you before you go to sleep or something like that? Or is it lights out the second your head hits the pillow? All right. You ever slept with somebody and you thought that something was off because they were asleep the second the head hits the pillow? And then maybe, all right, it's that kind of thing. When you don't have a conscience to keep you up or awake at night, you'll be surprised what you can do, right? They're living the dream, so to speak.
Yeah, it makes me think of a lot of David Lynch movies. I've done several analyses of his films, and he often deals with, you mentioned living the dream. I mean, his theme is surrealism, which is psychopathic characters oftentimes are literally thinking that they live in a dream state. So for them, there's the seamless blend between the waking and the dream state. And if you look into something like the Black Dahlia Avenger case, that was all based on the surrealistic art of Man Ray, who would do these artworks that were all about like human dismemberment and ritual sacrifice and so forth. And there's something absolutely metaphysically deep about what you're saying about this waking state, dream state for the psychopath. And if you do some research, as I'm sure you've done, about psychopaths, you'll see that many of them talk that way. In fact, George Hodel, one of the top suspects in the Black Dahlia Avenger case, literally said, I believe that I had no distinction between my waking and dream state. And so because I thought I lived in a dream state, like, it doesn't matter what I could do. I could chop up bitches all day long because it's just a dream and life is a dream, right? And so, you know, you start to see that kind of stuff and you see that even put into film. I think David Lynch is a really good director and really good at showing that in a weird, very bizarre atmosphere that he creates in his films. You can actually get an insight into psychopathy. And if you watch a movie like Lost Highway or Mulholland Drive, the dissociative states and how psychopaths can even have that experience as well. So kind of tying into that Archon demonic sort of thing in the background that you were, the shade side that you're talking about.
The one characteristic that I found was the most interesting about psychopathic characteristics is they have the ability to project a false reality to the people that are in their presence. Right? Like they've actually got a projected hologram, like you think differently than what you're actually seeing in real time. And I was like, fuck. That's scary, right? I mean, think about all the stories of, like, dragon slayers. Do you think those dragon slayers weren't scared shitless when they were going up against this giant beast that could breathe fire and had claws the size of his arm? Of course they were scared, but they were really frightened of what would happen if they just let the dragon eat all the villagers and all the sheep and what would happen to the earth when it got burned and scorched into dust. And sometimes you have to brave a lot of risk and sacrifice a lot for others who might not even know your name or appreciate you or ever remember you. All right. That's the kind of commitment that this movement really needs to have to the truth, especially the truth about ourselves. Jay, thank you very much. Jay's analysis is his very fantastic website, jaysanalysis.com. I believe that's right, isn't it?
Yeah.
All right. Excellent.
It is. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for listening in, and we'll see you again sometime at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com.